Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 33, Anti-Wi-Fi Decorating.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcasts.com/TWiL. And by listeners like you. Thanks so much for your contribution. We couldn't do TWiT without it.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Law, episode 33. I'm Denise Howell. I'm here as usual, Friday mornings at 11 o'clock Pacific, if you're listening and watching live at live.twit.tv, with a panel of experts to talk about the latest issues in the world of technology law. So with us today, we've got Colette Vogel from VogelLaw.com. Colette, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Denise. As always, great to be here.
Great to have you back. Also with us is a newcomer to TWiL, Gordon Firemark. Gordon, good to see you.
Hi, Denise. Thanks. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Gordon is an entertainment lawyer in Los Angeles with a background also in the theater. And I owe Gordon a big thanks for coming down and waving his magic hands over my mixer to ensure that it was working properly so that I can once again use my actual microphone and not the headset mic that I'd been kind of limping along with. So thanks so much, Gordon, for doing that. And Gordon also does the Entertainment Law podcast.
It's called Entertainment Law Update.
Entertainment Law Update. Thank you so much. And where else can folks find you, Gordon, online?
My primary website is firemark.com. And on Twitter, I'm gfiremark.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your practice? Because we tend to have people on more on the technology side than on the entertainment side. But I think in today's day and age, they are starting to go more hand in hand.
Absolutely. That convergence is really happening in a big way. My practice, I've been practicing for 17 and a half years or so. And in that time, we've seen the independent film world and the technology worlds really coming together, some would say collide. And so it's been a part of my role as the lawyer to keep up on both sides of it and find ways for the content creators that I represent to work with the content, these new forms of sort of distribution as well as the content consumers. So that's where I sort of fit into the technology side of things. My practice is largely representation of independent filmmakers. And I do a little bit of music and, as you said, some theater work as well. And a little bit of technology and internet and other stuff thrown in there for kicks.
So give us an idea what kind of clients you typically represent. Who are you doing some work with?
My typical client is sometimes it's just a screenwriter who's selling a screenplay to a producer or something like that. But as often as not, it's the producer themselves who are acquiring the rights to develop some material, then going out looking for the financing for the production, and through the production process, all of the deal making that goes on for the licensing of the content that's within the content, and then through the distribution process with deals with distributors, the advertising and marketing folks that are involved in production of distribution of films, and then of course there's chasing down the money, the stuff that we lawyers love to do when something isn't going quite right. So,
right. So it sounds like in addition to helping people work out their licensing and IP considerations, you're also integrally involved in helping move things along, getting them made?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
That's very cool. What have you been involved in that we might have seen or that we can check out?
You know, I don't like to identify my clients specifically. I feel there's some confidentiality things there. There have been a, you know, a handful of independent movies over the last few years that have come out that I've been a part of, and yeah, I'd rather not name.
That's okay. That's just fine. So let's dig into some of the things that we were going to talk about this week, current events in the world of technology law. There's so much. I'm not quite sure where to start. And we are waiting for one other member of our panel who's having Skype issues, and that is Matt Nico. So I'm hoping that we can get him on soon. And there's a couple of things I want to save for him. But in the meantime, let's dive into this one's kind of short and sweet. The fact that there's a bit of a ping pong going on between sports organizations and how they are endeavoring to control the live reporting of their events. There was a restriction on live blogging by the NFL, and the blogger who decided to flaunt that restriction actually works for the venerable Wall Street Journal and didn't actually sit in the stadium and live blog something, but just did something that any of us could do, sit in his living room and watched the football game between the New York Jets and the Tennessee Titans and live blogged it, seemingly in contravention of the NFL's guidelines and rules. But as far as I know, this comes our way from Tech Dirt, and looking at the comments there, it doesn't look like there's been any backlash from this. What do you guys think about sports organizations trying to have such tight control? Is it a futile thing? Is it a silly thing? Why don't we start with you, Gordon, from the entertainment lawyer's perspective?
Well, if you think of the sports organization as a content creator, and I think there's some argument either way on that, you know, content creators do own what they create, or at least try to own what they create. Now, with something like a sporting event where it's unscripted, it's, you know, it's happening in real time, I have some reservations about it being a form of property they can exercise that kind of control over. Although I think over the course of the television history anyway, the sporting organizations have successfully argued that the games are their property. But
I guess a counter argument to that would be that it's actually news or something.
It's factual stuff too. This is you know, when someone's live blogging it, this is what's happening. They, you know, so and so ran this many yards for this kind of a, you know, touchdown or whatever.
Right.
So facts aren't protected by copyright law. There may be other arguments, and I think the contract that a spectator makes when they purchase a ticket might, you know, bind them to a promise not to blog the events. But when the thing goes on television, and someone sitting in the comfort of their own home or office and, you know, re-articulating what's happened, I think that changes the equation a little bit.
Colette, what are your thoughts on the live blogging controversy? You're on mute, my dear.
I'm so sorry.
There you go.
Have occasional fire trucks, you know, try not to ruin the sound. But I think it's a great question. You know, I'm on the side of technology, and sort of there's a legal and a practical problem that I think needs to be resolved. The practical problem is, can these organizations really stop their fans from writing about them and blogging it? And I think that's a futile effort. I think technology is going to keep developing and things are going to keep changing, and there's going to be a constant effort to try and stop something that they don't have control over. And I think there's a benefit to letting go of some of that control and gaining more viewers and fans and niche audiences and things. So that's sort of the practical question on some level. That's where I come at this. But on the legal side, there are some super interesting questions. You know, if it's a cable program, is anything in your cable agreement preclude? Could they add things to your cable agreements that preclude you from this, just like they do with, like Gordon mentioned, with sporting event ticket purchases? You know, is this the entertainment and sports and entertainment industry trying to your the privacy of your home and your own life to do things that we used to do when we would sit in a bar together or sit in someone's house watching it together? We'd tweet or, you know, we'd speak about things happening. And so what is so objectionable about putting it in a post or a Twitter microblogging site or on Facebook or whatever? And so that's interesting to me, to what extent can they try and accomplish that through EULAs or through contract law? And then also the outside of copyright, there's the hot news doctrine kind of stuff that has been litigated before. And I'm not sure where it is today. I recall, you know, studying it in law school and paying attention here and there. But I think there have been some new cases in the last year that, you know, re-bring this issue up about, it used to be pagers, you know, they would report sports scores on pagers, and was that legal? And now anyone can report this stuff to anyone. So,
you know, I think the league's big concerns aren't about the casual user, the equivalent of the folks talking about the game in the bar, or even, you know, talking on the phone to a buddy and telling them what's going on. I think what they're really concerned about is that there are companies out there, a business of this, by selling advertising on their blogs or selling, you know, access to the information itself. And that is the thing that the content owner really wants to preserve for itself. You know, that's why it's investing in creating the content in the first place, is to monetize that.
So my reaction is, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's an issue that they're trying to harness the money around the events that are happening or the facts that are occurring. My answer to that is, though, then they should do an excellent job of releasing that information so that people come to their site and look at their advertising and get the information there as quickly as possible. You know, it's a sort of a competition issue then. You know, who makes the information most interesting and accessible and useful? And if you do that well, then you will have the eyeballs and you will sell the advertising.
I agree. I mean, I think actually what's going on here is that rather than seizing an opportunity, these companies are trying to hold on to an old business model. And I think they could do a lot by encouraging fans and spectators to publicize what's going on in the game. And that might actually undermine the ability of these other entities to capitalize on this so much.
Right. On the one hand, you have networks like Current, and I've seen this elsewhere as well, encouraging watchers, viewers, listeners, users to jump in and participate in back channel fashion to the event as it's unfolding live. You guys remember the presidential debates last year where Current had a partnership with Twitter and was showing people's tweets about the debates as they were unfolding in real time. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have the sports organizations still clinging to the fact that the live interaction of its viewers is not only something they don't want, but something they're going to actively go out and try and prevent. I think in the meantime here, we've been joined by Matt Nico.
Hi, I am here. Sorry about the technical difficulties I was experiencing and having missed the first 20 minutes or so of the show.
That's okay. We're really glad to have you here, Matt. Just to introduce Matt to the panel and our listeners, he is currently a consultant and the head of the in-house counsel committee of the IP section of the California State Bar. and formerly general counsel for Streamcast in the infamous, famous, or just very well-known Grokster litigation. So I'm really happy to have you here, Matt. Do you have any thoughts on this sports organization live blogging issue and where you see it unfolding?
Well, from a legal standpoint, I think that it's going to be pretty difficult for the leagues to try to prevent live blogging. And I think that it's from a business standpoint, it's foolhardy. I think that there ought to be the ability for people to engage socially, interactively in blogging. And I don't think they're going to lose viewers by having people blog. It's similar to the DVD industry. People are still going to the movie theaters because they're experiencing the movie in a theater and that type of a setting. And people are still going to go to the live venues, stadiums and arenas to watch sports. And they're going to watch it on TV because that's, you know, that's largely what sports is about. And they're going to continue to do that. So I think it's foolish for them to try to control in that sort of manner.
From a legal standpoint, do you think they're on strong footing?
You know, I'm not certain that they are on that. You know, I don't know that this this qualifies as hot news per se, because if it's minute by minute reporting, that is, I'm not sure that it qualifies as hot news. But I'm uncertain, to tell you the truth, whether they are on good legal standing on this, or whether it's just they're putting the hammer down and saying, you know, we control all rights and you can't do anything with it. It's the same, you know, with the NFL putting a notice on their show, the broadcast of a game, and saying you can't reproduce this. Whereas, in part, you can for fair use purposes. So a lot of those notices, they just try to intimidate, and I don't know that they're going to succeed in a legal basis, and I'd be really interested to see a court case on this and a decision on it.
Right, so you've got fair use coming in, as you point out, and as Gordon was pointing out, I think as you may have been coming on the line, this may be outside the realm of copyright protection entirely if what you're doing is simply reporting factual details. The score is X, Y quarterback just connected with Z receiver. You know, I don't know how much of that would actually be copyrightable.
Right. I think you've got a good point there.
Yeah. I mean, that's just not what copyright was intended to protect. And if I feel like the Copyright Act keeps getting used by various industries and parties. I mean, software industry is guilty of this too, but trying to extend the protection to things that it was not really intended to protect. And it feels like you're kind of fitting a square peg into a round hole, and you can get through the initial stages of a litigation or a threat letter or whatever. But when push comes to shove, I think that a lot of this stuff is stuff that was never really the focus of copyright in the first place. And, you know, it may feel wrong. And if it is, there may be some other way to go about, you know, other areas of law that might be more appropriate. But in the case of this live blogging stuff, I don't really see a copyright claim that would survive very long.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see those unfold in the courts.
I think this is just yet another example of content owners, and I put owners in air quotes, you know, claiming rights in things that they think they may own, but the law may not actually give them a right to own in the way they want to. But, you know, we see it, and they're not accounting for fair use. We've seen it in the YouTube takedown notices, things like that, where judges have later come along and said, look, no, you have to consider fair use before you issue these kinds of takedown notices. I think we'll, if we see litigation about this kind of thing at all, we'll have those same kinds of issues arising. You know, just because you claim you own something doesn't mean you actually do under the law. Certainly a good start. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, your claim of ownership and a nasty gram from a lawyer does the job and the trouble stops. But I personally have an issue with the journalistic integrity of the blogger sitting at home watching it on television and reposting, you know, an account of the events. Even if there's nothing legally wrong with it, I think there's some moral and ethical concerns. And, you know, the readers of those kinds of blogs, I think, deserve better. But that's not a legal issue.
Well, it seems to me if you're layering on commentary as well as simply just giving the blow by blow, I mean, there are valuable aspects to both. Someone's away from their TV screen, but they're hoping to keep up on the game and they know they're following someone who's going to live tweet it, that's, you know, something that I think gives some value. And then we could get into the copyright ramifications of that. But then if they're also, you know, doing as sports fans frequently do, talking about whether the coach is doing a good or bad job or players are, then I think that adds a whole other layer that both adds value and adds to the copyright equation, you know, if it's transformative or fair use or what have you.
You know, this reminds me a little bit of the attempts by the leagues to prevent fantasy sports leagues and basically saying, you know, you can't, we've got the rights in our players' names and their, you know, what position they play and the teams that they're playing in. And so we don't want you engaging in these using real players for fantasy sports leagues. And I think that was foolish. They lost on that count. And I think that they ought to just embrace the evolution of technologies that enable people to participate actively in what's going on in the sport.
Yeah, I didn't follow that too closely when it was all unfolding, but my guess is that there were some right of publicity claims asserted that you can't use our name and likeness, and that possibly the prevailing successful response was that fantasy sports leagues aren't commercial. Is that how it went, or was there more to it than that?
No, I think that's that is how it went. Although, you know, there certainly is, I think there is some commercial aspect to it, because a lot of the internet networks that engage in or allow fantasy sports, they're monetizing it in some fashion. I'm not a fantasy sports player, so I'm not sure about the particulars in that, though.
Okay, well, Matt, a few years ago, you were involved in what was then the mother of all copyright lawsuits pending in court. The successor to that title right now is probably the Viacom versus Google and YouTube case. And there's some stuff going on there, some information that just came out there. We had Greg Sandoval as a guest on our show last week. And between then and now, Greg has launched a new blog at CNET called Media Maverick and come out of the gate with some strong stories. One of them called "Did Viacom Find Smoking Gun in YouTube Case?" That's discussing some things that have come out in discovery in that case that... there are a couple of points to it. One is that it appears that documents are now confirming that, yes, indeed, there are personnel within Google who knew that there was infringing material on YouTube. Surprise, surprise. And we can talk about that in a little more detail. And also that there may have been employees there who uploaded infringing material to the YouTube service. And the thrust of the article is that this could be damaging, a smoking gun, if you will, to Google in the litigation. Matt, why don't you take the first crack at that, since there were some smoking guns in your own case?
Well, there were some smoking guns found on summary judgment in the MGM Grokster case, and in terms of Morpheus, which was the P2P application that Streamcast produced and distributed. Not sure what would have happened in front of a jury, or if there had actually been a trial, and had we had the opportunity to contest that, we would have. But I think that in this particular case with Viacom and Google, I think the real pertinent question is, Were those employees authorized to upload those videos? Were they doing that in their capacity as employees of YouTube, or were they simply somewhat misguided and were doing it on their own, uploading videos on purely on their own that either they knew were infringing or didn't know that they were infringing? And then, of course, one of the questions and one of the issues that, that came out of the Supreme Court in the MGM Grokster case is, was there an intent in building the business for users to infringe? Was that the predominant purpose of YouTube? And I'm sure YouTube is going to argue and has argued that the predominant purposes were user-generated content that were non-infringing. So I think that I'm not sure how big of a smoking gun this is. And in terms of YouTube's knowledge about there being infringing content, you know, is that generalized knowledge saying, yeah, we know that there's some infringing content up there, or do they have to have specific knowledge as to what the infringing content is and what user posted it so that they can then take it down if, in fact, they receive a takedown notice?
You know, I think it's also an interesting question is to ask whether every employee of YouTube, because of the nature of their business, is imputed with the understanding and knowledge of what is infringing content. You know, just because, you know, some, well, I suppose many of them do have to know what infringing work looks like and what kinds of works will be infringing. But there may be employees there who, you know, were talking about a particular video and not realized that it was infringing, or may have concluded, you know, wrong or right, that it was fair use or something like that. And so I think the questions are a lot deeper than did YouTube have knowledge, but what specific kind of knowledge did YouTube have about a particular post?
Colette, can you help us understand under the DMCA the role that actual knowledge would play in this case?
Sure. So in order to be protected by or be safely in the harbor, the safe harbor that the DMCA provides, a service provider has to land on one of four islands, as I like to say. And I copy and I attribute Fred von Lohman for the island analogy. he's got some great slides that describe this. But to end up on an island, YouTube relies on being seen as a service that allows that hosts other people's content. And under that part of the DMCA, they have to not have, quote, actual knowledge, and I'm reading from the statute over here, actual knowledge that the material or activity actual knowledge that the material or an activity using the material on the system or network is infringing. And then in the absence of such knowledge, they are also not aware of facts and circumstances from which, quote, infringing activity is apparent. So those, that language is what we're talking about. And is if the service provider remains sort of blind in a way of what's, you know, of the actual content that could be infringing on their site, they maintain their protection. They have some other hoops to jump through, like they have to have a repeat infringer policy and respond expeditiously to notices of infringement. And there are some other requirements as well. But this actual knowledge element is critical. And it in a sense, it almost encourages these service providers to not look at their site. I mean, if you're working in a small company that's brand new and there's four employees and they're rapidly coding and putting their stuff up and making, you know, their service available for other people to post content on, you know, the last thing they should be doing is reviewing what their users are doing and coming upon information that might suggest that it is apparent that the activity is infringing. So, you know, a content owner will take a very strong view that, you know, that's, that language means as soon as your employee, any employee in the company sees something and says, I wonder if Comedy Central is uploading this stuff or if this user who's uploaded it has a license or is this a fair use? I mean, as soon as anybody in the company questions that I think a content owner is going to take the position, well, that's facts and circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent. And then the other side of this coin is, you know, a more liberal view of that. And in my view, a position that is more in line with the purpose behind the DMCA and the reason Congress made this trade-off when this was passed, you know, over 10 years ago, that the service provider isn't supposed to presume that everybody who's posted something is unlicensed and not making a fair use and not doing anything. It's supposed to be a platform where lots of activity can take place. And when the service provider is put on notice, they will immediately respond to that notice and review the content and remove it if they want to maintain their harbor. Apologize for the fire sirens in the background.
But that's okay. This is an emergency situation, perhaps.
Yes. So that's kind of that's sort of the nutshell of where this issue falls within the structure of Section 512 of the Copyright Act. And I think this tees up a lot of issues in the Veo case recently. They maintained their protection under the DMCA at summary judgment. So, I mean, it's not a cheap thing to be a relatively new company and having to be subject to a lawsuit and going all the way to the point of summary judgment before you can win. But in that case, they did win and they did maintain their protection in the safe harbor in circumstances where you could argue that maybe they should have known, had reason to know, other forms of knowledge, but not necessarily facts and circumstances from which infringing activity is apparent. So,
and in fact, when the user uploads to one of these sites, they're making a representation that they have the right to do so, that they own the material or have permission to do so. And I think another complication is the fact that the Viacoms are also posting stuff themselves. So yeah. I think, to require the every employee of YouTube to look with skepticism at every post they happen across is, not what the DMCA is really about.
No, that's an onerous burden to put on the service provider. And certainly I don't think that every employee can have encyclopedic knowledge of every work. And if you take classical music, for example, the underlying compositions for a Beethoven piece is in the public domain, but if that piece was performed by the LA Philharmonic, then the sound recording is not in the public domain. So how is an employee to make those kinds of distinctions?
Exactly.
This is complicated stuff for the lawyers who have to make these analyses, much less, non-lawyers who work in these companies in jobs that aren't about determining what's fair use, what's not, what's infringing, what's not. Yeah, that's my point.
And if I can say, in these DMCA cases in the litigation front, some of it is theatrics. Maybe Gordon, being a theater lawyer, you can relate to this. I mean, I'm sure you can. The theatrics in the court and even in the briefing is paint them as a bad guy. Paint the defendant as someone who's just using this as smoke and mirrors to do something that they know is nefarious, that they know is wrong, that they know they have to pay millions of dollars for in a normal world or something. And so some of this is theatrics that the plaintiffs in the YouTube case are going to say, aha, look at this. The YouTube claims they have no knowledge of any of this stuff. How could that be possible when 500 of their employees have uploaded themselves clips from Comedy Central or whatever. I'm just using that one example, but other things that they know are or should know are infringing. And it's just a kind of a nice little dig, but I think when a judge thoughtfully reviews that and thinks about, well, are they uploading on behalf of YouTube or is it just their personal thing? And I think it does make some nice theatrics, but I think at the bottom, hopefully the court will look more carefully at what the facts actually are in concluding anything about knowledge on that question.
And I think it would be very interesting to know if YouTube has a policy in its employees' handbook that basically says no employee is to upload any material unless they are certain beyond any doubt at all that that material is non-infringing or is fair use. And otherwise, they're prohibited from doing so. I think that that would be a very interesting fact to know. That I don't know. If does anyone know whether that's there's any written policy on that?
I don't know,
but it seems like it would be that the actual impact of such a policy would be that YouTube employees simply wouldn't be uploading if they were complying with the policy, because the burden of knowing, you know, unless you shoot it yourself and have permission from every single subject and no background music and, you know, satisfying those particular requirements is pretty hard, shadow of a doubt. So, you know, I'd be surprised, especially given that the actual terms of service for YouTube, as Gordon pointed out, require people to make representations when they upload.
The terms of service that everyone reads before clicking the box I accept.
Those ones.
Yes. Speaking of YouTube and popular culture, if I can for a moment, I was watching a very funny television show last night, The Office, and two of the characters were getting married. And I hope this isn't a spoiler alert. Anyone who watches The Office and hasn't seen this episode yet, give me 10 seconds. Take your turn your volume off. But they did the wedding dance that is now so popular on YouTube. The Jill and Kevin wedding dance set to Chris Brown's song Forever. And so we've got a song that is on YouTube, presumably with under license or consent of Zomba Records of Chris Brown.
Didn't they decide that all the production on that was so good and so tight, the audio, that I haven't heard that it actually was confirmed that it was all authorized, but that was the speculation.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's just fascinating to me that, you know, in certain circumstances, we allow the culture to use reuse and make derivative works or transformative works, and whether it's fair use or not, it's great. And then so all of a sudden here it's become so popular that now it ends up on a very popular network television show in yet another format. And so, you know, I just wanted to bring that into the conversation as how I think we need to look at copyright law in some way. And that's, you know, what is society doing in point of fact? And how do we accommodate society and its needs without criminalizing the activity of participants?
You know, I just want to throw one more little wrinkle in there, is we also have to remember that choreography is something that's protected under copyright law if it's fixed in a form. And so I wonder if they, you know, the lawyers at the network or the production company did anything to clear the choreography in that situation, or needed to.
Or anything else.
That's the theater lawyer thinking.
Yeah, I don't think the dancing in The Office down the aisle quite matched what the Jill and Kevin video,
so a poor rendition makes it on it.
No, I only saw the beginning of the show, but I'm looking forward to seeing the end, and my head is somewhat spinning about what NBC's lawyers must have done or thought about before they went forward with that. Maybe nothing. Maybe they just...
Objection assumes facts not in evidence.
Yeah, exactly. you know, was it Jill and Kevin? Were they the original?
Yes. Yeah, they were the originals on that. And then there's also a divorce video that kind of takes place in the courtroom that is a satire of the Jill and Kevin video. So it's all very interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're going to, so then let's take it one step further. Someone takes the clip of The Office and re-uploads it to YouTube so that people can see how that bit of video has evolved and been built upon.
Well, then, I would certainly say that if that happens, there should be some commentary that accompanies it and does a comparison to the Jill and Kevin video and has some sort of commentary on the social evolution of the use of this song and the video, and maybe that'll qualify as fair use. And if they only right. do that small clip instead of taking the entire 1 hour episode of The Office, I would think that would qualify for fair use.
Right. So that circles us back to this question of whether any of this is really a smoking gun in the Viacom litigation. You know, I think under the DMCA, what we're trying to establish, what Congress was trying to establish, is a way for service providers to not have to navigate that thicket and simply, you know, take what reasonable steps they can and be in a responsive role as opposed to, you know, the front gate police. But I guess that's the central issue in that case, and we'll watch eagerly to see how it unfolds.
We will. And what worries or troubles me to a certain extent about the DMCA and all of this is the part of the DMCA that says that if there are standard technical measures available to prevent or minimize copyright infringement, that in order to be under the safe harbor, those standard technical measures need to be utilized or implemented. And I think that a lot of the content owners and the content industry is slowly but surely trying to have technical measures implemented so that at some point they will just walk into court and say, you know, 50% of user-generated content sites use this standard technical measure. This company here doesn't use this standard technical measure, probably because they're a startup and they can't afford to license whatever that standard technical measure is, and therefore they don't qualify under the safe harbor. So I'm really curious to see what's going to happen in terms of YouTube and its developing and implementing a filtering system, and whether that will then be licensable to other entities, as Audible Magic is licensable to P2P entities in an attempt, and I'm not going to talk about its effectiveness in actually filtering, because that's somewhat questionable, or what the licensing costs are. But you know, I think that we're getting to the point soon that there will be that question as to whether a standard technical measure has been implemented.
Is that what the DMCA calls for, a standard technical measure? Or, I mean,
accommodates and does not interfere with. Yeah.
Okay. So, but YouTube is in the unfortunate situation of possibly being the standard setter here. And what does that mean for its own litigation?
Well, I think what YouTube is, and Google, and not to badmouth them in any sense, but they have so much money and such great market predominance in many areas. You know, there's the Google book settlement and what the implications of that may be, that if in fact they have developed or are developing a technical measure to do away with infringing content, that they will probably at some point implement it, won't license it, or if they do license it, it'll be for a tremendous amount of money. The content owners will then say, oh, well, this is a standard technical measure based upon market share rather than based upon numbers of user-generated content sites. And possibly that will reduce competitiveness in the marketplace for user-generated content sites.
Right.
Yeah, there's also a little bit of a disincentive to innovate in that area, because if YouTube creates something that is, you know, workable, it's reasonable, whatever, and that becomes the standard, then nobody needs to create something better, more efficient, more effective. And I think then we're going to get into that argument that we started to see in VO that didn't go very far there, but that it wasn't, that there weren't good enough measures in place. And so right. the standard may not be good enough for, you know, to satisfy content owners. And at some point, I think we're going to see that argument come back up.
Okay, well, let me jump in just because I have the statute pulled up and I always gravitate towards the text in front of me. But we're talking about Section 512I, and it talks about accommodation of technology. And there's a definition for standard technical measures that's actually not as horrifying. I mean, it's not great, but it's not as horrifying as I think we're starting to say it is. It says that the term standard technical measures means technical measures that are used by copyright owners to identify or protect copyrighted works, and then there's three requirements. They have been developed pursuant to a broad consensus of copyright owners and service providers in an open, fair, voluntary, and multi-industry standards process, are available to any person on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, and do not impose substantial costs on service providers or substantial burdens on their systems or networks. So it sounds like the statute's built in some fairness, openness. I don't know that if Google came up with the golden tool that they could only provide it on some extremely burdensome, costly measure. If one of the requirements for something to be a standard technical measure under the statute means that the costs imposed cannot be substantial burdens on the system or network. So if you say that a financial cost is a burden. So anyways, I just wanted to flag that as something to think about. But I am concerned about filtering. And so far, the filtering technology that I'm familiar with or have heard of, the problem here is it's pretty impossible for a machine to determine if a clip is fair use or not. Music or images, you know, if they match the fingerprint of a piece of content that's in the database, you can't tell from that just match that it's a commentary or it's a parody, for example, where you really have to use the full content in order to make your point in many cases. So that's the biggest criticism I've heard of the filtering technologies in addition to the potential burdens.
Right. So it keeps fair use material in many instances off the site entirely without going through the DMCA process, which is designed to actually let fair use material through and have a discussion about it through the notice and takedown and response process.
Exactly.
So let's shift gears here. And well, before we do, I wanted to ask Matt, since we are privileged to have him on the show, we were talking about how the fallout of this may lead to barriers to innovation. And of course, that was the big concern with the Grokster case that came out from the Supreme Court a few years back. And I just wanted to, you know, a few years down the road here, Matt, what do you see as the fallout from Grokster? Do you think that the things that we were frightened about have come to pass? Are they still out there as sort of a ticking time bomb? What's your take on the aftermath of that case?
I think it's out there as a ticking time bomb. I think that innovators who are aware at all about the implications of the Grokster case are frightened to a certain extent, and they don't know whether they're going to be able to distribute their technology or their product or their website. For fear that they're going to get sued. And, you know, I think that there has been a bit of a pressure on innovators to go to the content providers and to try to work out deals with them. And that's not an easy thing to do. So I think that there has been a negative impact on innovation. Of course, it's hard to tell. The economy hasn't been great for the technology sector the last year or so, and so that has an impact as well. But I do think that there is that issue.
what's the fundamental difference for people who either aren't familiar with or have forgotten about, because it was a few years ago, the fundamental difference for companies coming out of the gate now in the post-Grokster era than prior to the decision?
Well, I think the fundamental difference is that they can no longer simply say, okay, we are putting out a product that could be used for good things and bad things, and we're not going to take into account the percentage of misuse to which this product can be put. They can no longer say, you know, we're totally agnostic on this issue. They have to be very cautious, of course, in their discussions, in their business plans, in their marketing plans, to avoid bringing up the topic of the use or the misuse of the service or the technology or the product by end users. And they really have to be very careful to make sure that they're marketing their product and thinking about their product in a way that is for non-infringing and authorized uses. And if they aren't doing that, then they can find themselves in trouble down the line.
Do you think that it goes so far as, tying back into our Viacom and Google discussion, that if a company is being proactive and thinking about standard or non-standard filtering technologies and trying to be a good corporate citizen and actually having discussions about the potential for infringement and trying to implement preventative kind of measures, that that actually can come back to bite them under the Grokster decision?
You know, I don't know if you know, I certainly think that in the P2P world, they have to think about implementing technical measures at this juncture following the Grokster decision. In the service provider world, where you still have the safe harbors under the DMCA, I don't think that they have to do so yet. So I think that it's somewhat narrow and is dealing with the world of technology that's not covered under the DMCA and the safe harbor provisions of the DMCA. So in anything involving P2P, I think that that's going to be important. I'm really curious to see. I don't know very much about it, but everyone's talking about Wave and Google's Wave, and whether that has P2P aspects to it and whether that therefore takes it outside of the realm of being a service provider. And if so, what kinds of technical measures are going to be, what kinds of technical measures they're thinking about, if any at all, or what they're going to implement.
Right, because when you think about Wave, it is, however it operates, it is a transport layer that any kind of content could flow over.
Right. As far as I know, and I really haven't looked at it very much. I've just caught little tidbits of information about it.
Right. So if so to make the distinction between something like email and something like Wave, or say something like Twitter, which we do know about and is out there, Twitter, I think, pretty clearly falls into the DMCA realm, would be able to afford itself of those protections in that kind of situation. But you're saying that if Wave implements aspects of P2P technology, then they might be opening a whole can of worms?
I think so. I do think so. And so I think that's something that's problematic, and it's problematic for anyone doing any sort of peer-to-peer or distributed computing, that they always have to be conscious of the fact that infringing content could be transported over there or utilizing their software or their applications or their technologies, and that they really need to wonder whether they're covered under the DMCA, and if not, they've got to look at those Grokster factors that the Supreme Court laid out for active inducement.
Great news for Google, as usual.
So, Denise, can you do some magic and get us Wave invitations?
Oh, you know, a Twitter user and listener at XPR on Twitter after my last show, when I begged on all of our behalf for a way of invitations, I think has lined me up with one, but he also says that they are hand entering over there at Google because the demand is so vast for these things. Each invitation request at a time. And so far nothing has manifested itself, but I will once again beg on behalf of all of the 12 panelists, that, we'd all love to give Wave a try and see how it works and begin to think intelligently about, what its legal ramifications might be. So, if you can help us out, please do. Let's talk for a bit about, termination of copyrights. This is kind of a funny, esoteric thing that is bubbling up. And I love the headline on one of our show note links that is "The Fight Over Funky Town," which being the song that came out in, I think they said it was 1978. Anyway, the timing of it was such that the artist itself is getting to the point where they can terminate the transfer of their copyrights to other entities that may have been involved in production and distribution, et cetera, and actually recover the work. So this would apply to both artists and also heirs to artists, since copyright is so very long that, you know, if the actual artist is no longer around, then the successors in interest to that artist can also avail themselves of this. And Matt, thanks so much for the links to the cool copyright terminations calculator and tools. One is from a law student at, I think it was the University of North Carolina. Mm-hmm. The other one is from Creative Commons. Why don't you expand on this a bit and tell our listeners why termination of transfer is important and what these tools can do for them?
Well, I think the importance of termination of assignments and transfers is something that's really good for creators and has been argued against by the content industry, who is the middleman very often and is not necessarily the creator. Of course, sometimes the content industry is a creator and an author as well. But I think that this sort of limits the life of a copyright in the hands of the middleman and returns the copyright to the author or the author's heirs, and enables them to possibly negotiate a better deal than the deal that they had when they first entered into the agreement with the assignees of these copyrights. And I'm not an expert on it. It's a little bit technical, but I think that beginning this year or next year, copyright holders that created works, I don't have my notes in front of me on this, and so if anyone else knows the technicalities of the years, please jump right in. But if I think it's if you created or assigned your work before 1978, you now have the ability to send the assignee a notice saying, "I'm going to be terminating my copyright assignment, and I want it back." So for viewers and listeners out there, there is a link that has the article that talks more specifically about it. I'm sure if you use a search engine and input copyright termination, you'll find a lot of information about the particularities of it. But I think that there's a battle that's going to be coming up on this. The record labels are not going to be very happy about this, particularly record. I mean, any of the content holders, but particularly record labels, I think, are going to be facing a lot of interesting situations here in terms of their artists sending these copyright termination notices and trying to figure out how to deal with them.
Right. So the article by Eric Gardner that we have in our show notes talks about Lee Phillips, who's a named partner at Manatt Phillips & Phillips, big law firm in Los Angeles, and represents folks like the Eagles and Journey and Barbara Streisand. And he says that his firm and colleagues have begun gathering information about these old record contracts and copyright registrations, and is promising to be sending out termination notices on works that qualify by the end of this year. So I guess the Funky Town song is one of the first that went out. I think that's being handled by somebody else. And then so we'll, you know, see if this reverts back to the artist and they get to go forward. Now, I used one of the tools that you linked to, Matt, the UNC one, just to see, you know, what this might mean for people a little bit more current than 1978 and how the timing works out. My dad's an author, so I put in the year that his book was published. And he's not eligible to set out his termination notice to his publisher and anyone else he might have assigned rights to based on a 1999 publication until the year 2034. So I don't know how much practical goodness accrues to all of this for folks, you know, in the modern day who are looking after their copyrights. But for those of you who were creating back when the Eagles and Journey were huge, then maybe this is big news. Gordon, is this something that has crossed your radar? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, we talk about this a lot. You know, let's talk a little bit about the reason this law was built into the Copyright Act. The idea is that at the time that artists are creating their work originally, they often don't have much bargaining power. You know, when the Eagles are just getting started, they're a small band that's generated a little popularity, and okay, a record label comes along and wants to sign them to a deal. They don't have a lot of bargaining power in negotiating their royalty rates and their compensation and so on. And so here, you know, the record label makes a deal that's very, arguably very label friendly. And, you know, what happens then is an act becomes hugely successful, and they and their heirs will later feel that they were not properly compensated for the value they gave to the label. And there are a handful of very prominent cases involving a creative work for which artists were paid, you know, a pittance. And then that became a huge franchise. In particular, this has come up a lot in the comic book world. The creators of Superman were paid, you know, a few hundred dollars for the Superman character and the, all of the rights to the material, and never saw another penny from it for, you know, 35, 40 years or more. And so those cases have actually been litigated over this termination of transfer situation. You know, so this is a chance for, after the work has become big and successful, for those artists to essentially reopen the negotiations and bargain for some better compensation. And if the licensee or the assignee of the material isn't interested in those negotiations, then the copyright creator can recapture that copyright, terminate that transfer, and you know, put it out on the open market themselves and shop around for a better deal, or you know, sell to the consumer directly and get the value of the of what they've created. I think it was a reaction to the extreme length of the duration of copyright, and it's a way to you know, balance things a little bit out and back to the creators, who may later have better bargaining power than they do early on in those transfers.
Well, a bit later in the show, I do want to get to, sorry, Colette, you want to interject something here? I'm going to go to our Audible in a minute here. Go ahead.
Okay, I just had a quick question. Since I don't do sort of traditional entertainment work, I don't have that background from years ago. Is this termination of transfer something that can be rejected through contract? I mean, why don't the transfers say in their contract, at least since 1978, since this was enacted, why don't they say if the company getting the rights, why doesn't that agreement say for them, for their purposes, like any termination of transfer is void. We were done. This is it. This is an assignment. It's over. Or is that what they do now so that they don't have to worry about the heirs or the author coming back? I'm just curious if this is just being addressed now through contract or not.
You know, I haven't looked at that recently, but I do recall there being some public policy statements in the legislative history behind that provision that give the courts essentially the instruction that this is something that can't be waived by contract.
So interesting. And, yeah.
Yeah, and especially when you're dealing with heirs to the Asinor, you know, those kinds of waivers won't be binding on the heirs, but it's an open question. We might start to see that kind of language in contracts that I don't know whether it'll be enforced. I haven't seen it yet. Most of these early transfers, you know, this provision has come into effect recently enough that the transfers that it applies to happened before the law was in effect. So nobody thought to put in those waivers into the contracts.
Exactly. It is interesting. I have a friend who always likes to say that contract is the new copyright. So, you know, EULAs and contract law gets, you know, over all sorts of fair use things and other stuff for a lot of entities. So I was just curious if this might fit that theme as well.
Yeah. So. Well, I guess that's the whole concept behind Creative Commons.
Yeah. That's true too.
All right. So we've got a huge slate of stuff I'd still love for us to get to. We've got the FTC's new rules for bloggers. We've got anti-Wi-Fi paint. We've got some comic book copyright questions to look at as to who winds up with the rights to Marvel Comics. All of that after, though, we thank our sponsor, Audible.com, who has been a longtime sponsor of the show, and we're very grateful to have them on board. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can get a 14-day free trial of their Gold Listener program, which entitles you to download one free book per month. Well, once you start paying, it'll be one book per month that you're paying for as part of your subscription. And this morning, I got a call from my dad who was raving about this week's issue of the New Yorker magazine. Says it's just a phenomenal issue, full of great articles. And I listened and listened and said, yeah, you know, and I listened to him talk about the whole contents of the particular issue, which has something called, in its Annals of Communication section, a whole article on the history of Google and the financial ramifications and where it's going in the future. The current issue is all on financial issues. And let's see. So there's rumors about the flu vaccine. There's why the recession won't teach us frugality. All kinds of interesting things in the current issue. But I was kind of yawning away when my dad was telling me about this because, frankly, I just don't have time for another print magazine in my life, even something as good as the New Yorker. And then the little light bulb went on over my head that, oh yeah, Audible has lots and lots of newspapers and magazines, and I know that the New Yorker is one of them. So with your free trial at audiblepodcast.com/twill, you can get a one-month subscription to the New Yorker, which would include this great issue that my dad recommends, all on hot topics in finance, as well as another month's worth of publications. And that would be a great way to use your free trial. So that's what we're going to recommend this week for our Audible listeners. Thanks so much, Audible, for sponsoring the show. All right. So let us talk, shall we, about the FTC and what it plans to do in December to govern the rights of bloggers and the fines that it intends to impose if there are not proper disclosures made, if you are on the take, if you're receiving free items or payment and then blogging or tweeting or otherwise putting out online positive endorsements of something without disclosing that fact. Apparently, the FTC is going to step in and impose fines as big as $11,000 a pop for folks who are involved in these activities. Highly controversial, lots of discussion about this online this week. Colette, why don't you give us your thoughts?
My thoughts are, okay, so I'm a little bit conflicted about it. And here's my conflict, because I think bloggers have developed a lot since the beginnings. They are true journalists in many cases. They are citizen journalists. They are writing about all sorts of important things. And so shouldn't they be held to some sort of standard of ethics that professional journalists are held to? It doesn't seem unreasonable. But on the other hand, I feel that I feel like there's a potential here, and that the FTC, who for the last 8 years before Obama was president, I kind of felt like, wow, they're sort of not getting the internet, and so now we have a president and a commission that's maybe going to do more in the internet space, and maybe that's not a good thing. Maybe we like the hands off a little bit. So now they're going forward and passing regulations and putting things out there that are going to kind of affect the internet. It makes me a little bit nervous. And my nervousness comes from what is the problem they're trying to solve? What has happened that is so bad that they have to come in and regulate us and have some requirements placed? I don't know that this has been a serious problem, but I don't know, you know, all the data that they looked at before they passed this new regulation. So that's where I am kind of in conflict. I think a good ethical writer would disclose their affiliations or their freebies that they get. And that's just what, you know, what I hope is going to happen. And the good, you know, the ethical sort of more professional bloggers will be seen as that will become the trusted sources of information on the web. At the same time, I consider myself to be a pretty web savvy person, and I hope I can tell the difference between someone who's sort of out there spouting their mind in a way that I don't care to read, and I cannot read that, and I go to places that I think are more more reputable. But maybe someone else new to the web or new, I don't know, some other people may not have that level of sophistication, and so maybe this is a way to protect some of that in the distribution of content. So I don't know. I have very mixed feelings about whether this was really necessary or needed, and is it needed at this time, especially given the costs that could be imposed on a blogger.
Yeah, I have a couple of reservations about it. The first being that it imposes a level of cyberspace exceptionalism, to use Professor Goldman's term yet again, that we don't necessarily need, want, require, or might be a good thing, where, you know, if you're reading the New York Times Book Review, I don't remember ever seeing a disclosure that, yes, those reviewers received those books for free before they read them and review them. And I guess in mainstream journalistic circles, there may be a standard or practice or code that at some point you return some of your review copies of things. I've certainly had things sent to me unsolicited for review and gotten them both ways. Something that the company expected me to keep and review if I wanted to, and placed no other restrictions on what that review might consist of. And then I've also received things that had, you know, return packaging included so that I could return the thing once I was done evaluating it, if I did indeed choose to review it. So, you know, I think that's where we get into a problem. If the FTC is hoping to target the more underhanded pay-per-post kind of approach, where somebody's pretending to be one thing, but actually on the take, then you know, I could see the merit to that part of it. But I think it's, as you point out, Colette, really hard to regulate. Guys, Gordon, what do you think about all this?
Well, you know, there's a part of me that feels, you know, it doesn't seem like it's too much to ask a blogger to say such and such company sent me one of their new cell phones to review, and here's what I think. I don't think that's an undue burden on the blogger. Now, when it's a cash payment or something like that, it certainly does undermine in a different way the perception of that blog post. Maybe that's a good thing. I mean, that's what this is designed to protect against. The consumers, I think many of us are, as you said, Colette, savvy internet users, and, you know, can kind of have a sense of what's an advertisement and what's not, and when editorial content has a slant because of its affiliations or so on. But there's an awful lot of folks out there who don't, and especially kids. And let's talk about who the consumers that internet stuff is really aimed at. A lot of the time, it's young people who don't have that maybe a jaded perspective on things. Mm-hmm. You know, where's the money for this coming from? And so we do need to protect them. On the other hand, you know, it is an infringement or an impingement on the speech rights of both the bloggers and the product manufacturers that are getting these reviews. But I don't think it's really an unreasonable restriction. The fines trouble me a lot, though.
Yeah, they are pretty onerous. Matt, do you think that we're getting into dangerous ground when the FTC is trying to draw distinctions between a blogger and a journalist?
You know, I think it's a matter of degrees. And I think that, I don't know the particularities of the regulation and what the levels and standards are, and whether, you know, there's a dollar price point of value of whatever the blogger or reviewer is receiving that kicks in on this regulation. I think that to a certain extent, we have to take responsibility for ourselves. And, you know, if it's children, then parents have to raise their kids to have a certain degree of skepticism when it comes to, you know, crowds and following trendsetters and tastemakers. And, you know, I think that's the real, one part of the real issue here is, you know, where are we getting our information, and where are we learning to buy from? And is it from advertising nowadays? Is it from trendsetters who are talking about products or wearing products? It's an interesting issue, but I don't know that the FTC, except in extraordinary and egregious situations, should be getting involved here. I don't necessarily think this is a First Amendment issue, because it does involve a degree of commercial speech. I think that so that it takes it out of the realm of being purely a First Amendment free speech issue. I do worry that we're over-regulating things, and I'm not sure that government has a place there. And I think that people need to take personal responsibility and to know, look, if you know you're following a Nicole Richie blog, or who was it? Kim Kardashian, I think, was the example given. And she's always promoting something. Then, you know, is she to be a trusted tastemaker, or should you just be skeptical about mm-hmm. that? You know, when it comes to really big things, I think that, you know, if it's we're talking about investments, we've got securities regulations that can deal with those sorts of things. You know, where are we going? Are we saying that any restaurant reviewer who receives a free meal at a restaurant needs to explicitly disclose, by the way, I received everything that I reviewed in this this restaurant review was given to me gratis? Or do we just do we know that? Is it just something that we have to assume and be wary of and cautious of? So I am concerned about this particular rule, and I think, you know, Gordon said, well, what's the harm of posting a disclosure?
I think we're all here.
Matt, you finish your thought. You're saying some harm.
Yeah, Gordon, you know, posting a disclosure is hard to do in a tweet when you have 140 characters. Will it be sufficient to just put that on your Twitter homepage that just says, by the way, I mention products and I receive these products often for free, or I receive remuneration to review these products. And it, will that be sufficient? And, you know, what if I start following somebody on Twitter and I don't really ever go to their homepage? I just hit follow. And so I never get an opportunity to read that disclosure. And how are we going to regulate the, you know, the placement of this disclosure and how often this disclosure has to be made? And, you know, it is somewhat burdensome, and I'm not sure that a need for this disclosure has adequately been shown. But you know, I haven't listened to or read the testimony.
Yeah, someone pointed out to me when it was first posted that the FTC is certainly betraying its lack of currency in how modern technological communications work. First, because they made this known by way of a standard press release. And secondly, because, yes, the whole notion of doing a disclosure in something as popular as Twitter would be very difficult. And go ahead.
Yeah, you know, historically, I want to just back up a little bit because, you know, yeah, they're regulating internet kinds of communications in a way that they haven't regulated, at least not as much, other mainstream media, because internet is pretty mainstream now. But, you know, broadcasters, print journalism, the print industry and so on over the course of their history, in order to avoid government regulation, have formed, industry groups and associations, and they've established some policies to sort of protect themselves, insulate themselves from government regulation. I'm thinking, for example, of the film industry's, the movie rating system is a voluntary system, but they all do it because the last thing they want is government coming in and saying, okay, this is what is appropriate for children under 17. So here we have a much bigger playing field and many fewer barriers to entry. Pretty much anybody with an internet connection can start a blog or get a Twitter account and start, you know, reviewing products and so on. And so far, we don't have an industry-wide or a media-wide set of standards. And so there's a perception somewhere, obviously, that those standards need to be established. And in the absence of the industry doing it themselves, the government's going to jump in and do it. This is the worst case scenario that the movie and print industries have envisioned.
Yeah, I'm not real wild about this having gone into effect, and I think people are going to have to err on the side of caution and have a disclosure page that they can point people to. You know, I think ethical journalists have done that for a long time, but a ridiculous degree.
Well, yeah, you know, I think the first time somebody gets a big fine, I think hopefully organizations like the EFF and ACLU and all will come in and help them fight it. And then we'll see, you know, some analysis, First Amendment and otherwise, about whether this regulation really should stand up.
Right. Okay, well,
comment stuff on this?
Go ahead, wrap this up.
I asked if the FTC did the normal notice and comment rulemaking procedures, and if so, why are we only hearing about it now when the regulation goes into effect?
I think they did. I'm looking at their one of their guidelines PDFs. It's 81 pages, but the table of contents suggests there was a review of comments on proposed revisions. So I think they did go through the normal notice and comment period, and this is the outcome of that.
Because the fact that this was under consideration came out quite some time ago, and so this is now the formal announcement that yes, we are going to have regulations, and here's what they're going to entail.
Right.
I wanted to jump back into our discussion about termination of copyrights because we have an example of one where the heirs to the Marvel comic book creations, heirs to comic book artist Jack Kirby, have sent out notices of copyright termination. Disney bought Marvel for $4 billion, and presumably it was very important to that price and acquisition that they were going to have all the rights and licensing they needed to use the Marvel characters such as Iron Man and Spider-Man and, or let's see, no, Sony has Spider-Man, it says. And Marvel is producing its own version of a second Iron Man film. But Disney clearly, did this acquisition with sweeping permissions in mind. And now the heirs to Jack Kirby are attempting to throw a wrench in that. It reminds me a little bit of the long and very acrimonious litigation between the family of A.A. Milne and Disney about the Pooh franchise and writings. Gordon, do you have any thoughts on this and what we might expect here? Are you with us? Gordon? Uh-oh. Okay, how about you, Matt?
Well, I think, first of all, Disney is a big boy, to put it in the singular, and Disney is perfectly capable of, and no doubt looked at these issues involving termination when they were making the decision to acquire the rights to Marvel, and I'm sure that this has been, or I don't know whether Marvel made reps and warranties saying, all of these rights are good and won't terminate, or what the reps and warranties were. But, I'm really not that hugely concerned about it. I think that if Kirby's heirs want to, if the termination provision in the Copyright Act came into existence for the purpose that we were talking about earlier, which is to allow someone who had unequal bargaining weight when they first assigned or transferred the copyright to renegotiate, then if this is worth money to Disney, then Disney will renegotiate with the heirs to Jack Kirby to make sure that those rights are given to Disney unabated. So, the big copyright holders can't get their way all of the time. And I think that this is something that does level the playing field a bit. And I'm sure that consumers are not going to have a dearth of content out there because content is being terminated left and right. I'm sure that there will be renegotiations, and I'm not terribly concerned about it from a standpoint of a consumer.
So this will be something that sort of unfolds behind the scenes, and maybe some money will change hands, but you don't think that anything's going to really stand in the way of Disney going forward and exploiting its $4 billion acquisition?
No, I don't. They may have to pay a little bit more money, but I don't think it's the production system is going to come to a screeching halt, and we're not going to have certain of the characters that were created by Jack Kirby in movies or theme parks.
Hey, Matt, have you taken a look at the Informed P2P User Act? And do you have any thoughts about that?
I haven't taken a look at it, but Streamcast was invited to testify 3 years ago, I think, in front of one of the committees that was looking at this issue 3 years ago. And just to set it out for listeners and viewers, basically the government has become concerned about the possibility of and supposed fact that classified documents or top secret documents are available through P2P applications on P2P networks because supposedly government employees or other users of computers that have installed P2P applications on their computers don't realize that they are putting certain documents into their share folders and thereby making those documents available to the world of P2P users. So supposedly there are, you know, top secret classified documents that are available out there, details about Secret Service details about a presidential motorcade and those sorts of things. And so there's a company called Tyversa, which has as one of its executives a former general who is talking in Congress about this great risk that exists. And while there may have been and there still may be P2P application providers who, as soon as you install that application on your computer, everything, every document, every folder becomes available to other P2P users. There are many other P2P application providers that doesn't happen automatically. You have to actually select files to put into your share folder in order for them to be shared. What the government wants to do, this informed P2P User Act is supposedly set to do, is to make sure that there's not an automatic inclusion of files within the share folder, first of all, and second of all, to give clear and plain English warnings to users, basically saying, are you sure you want to share this tax return and put your tax return into your share folder? It won't say tax return, but it'll say, you know, are you sure you want to share this file? And so, again, are we over-regulating? Should the regulation really just be, you know, make sure that a P2P application doesn't include within it. Sorry about my camera going in and out. I'm not sure why that is. But make sure that the regulation says, you know, you just can't include the universe of everything on your computer in your share folder. Or do we have to actually have some sort of disclaimer? And then if so, what kinds of applications does that extend to? Does that extend to instant messengers where you can attach something to an instant messenger? Does that include email? If you're about to attach a document to your email, you're going to have to say, is there going to be a warning that pops up and says, are you sure you want to include this document in your email? I don't think it goes that far, so I'm not going to, you know, make it seem that dreadful. But in terms of P2P, I'm not sure that this kind of regulation is actually necessary. I think that as far as the government is concerned, the government needs to tell its employees, don't use your computer, don't use a P2P application on your computer. Or if you do, here's how these P2P applications work, and don't put things in your share folder. So I'm not sure that the regulation is really necessary. On the other hand, when we learned of the possibility that there were these types of sensitive documents floating around in the P2P networks, we were extraordinarily concerned about this. You know, I certainly didn't want to be involved in a company that was putting lives at risk by having documents that were accessible through our application and searchable through our application. That's a horrible thing. And we actually suggested basically a tool to be that we were willing and happy to work with the government to do some sort of hash file filtering. So if they identified for us a hash file for a particular document, that we would attempt to implement in the P2P application a filter that would prevent anyone from either being able to download that. And so there are other solutions. There are technical solutions that exist out there. It may be an issue for some P2P applications and some people, and I think that it is of some concern, but I'm not sure that we need a law regulating this.
So I see that.
Am I just being cynical, or does the entertainment content industry also benefit tremendously from this kind of legislation?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Are they now
going to be, if this goes into effect, yeah, are they going to be in a position to basically say to the people they sue for infringement, well, now your defense of, but I didn't know I was sharing it, goes out the window?
Right. I see that it was sponsored by Mary Bona Mack from California, and I'm wondering, you know, if her constituents are a lot of the RIAA and MPAA players, because it seems like this could be good ammunition for them. And by the way, we should let people know this is just a bill at this point that has passed the House Energy and Commerce Committee this week, but has not yet made it into law. What do you think, guys? Do you think that this is maybe quietly, you know, masquerading under this national security kind of impetus, but that there's another agenda here?
Yeah, I think that that's a possibility, and certainly I would not put that past the content industries to conceive of this as being another tool for them to have in their toolbox in going after P2P users, although they, at least the labels say that they're not going to continue to do that. And we'll see whether that is in fact true, but there are certainly other content industries, including the Business Software Alliance, and whether they are interested in this at all. You know, certainly the movie studios and the TV networks, I think, yes, it's a great point, Gordon and Denise, that perhaps this in part is motivated by the desire to say, oh, you know, you are not an innocent infringer. And, you know, it may go to the argument, the making available argument, which the recording industry has put forth in many of its lawsuits, that basically says simply because you have a music file, an MP3 file in your share folder, then that's enough to establish that you in fact were contributing to copyright infringement, and we don't need to actually prove that anyone downloaded that particular MP3 from you, but simply by your making it available makes you a copyright infringer. And now that's just another tool in their arsenal, or could be another tool in their arsenal.
Especially if they can say, look, the software told you you were making this available, so don't come in arguing that you weren't or you didn't know.
Right. Another thing that users would just sort of automatically click through and be bound by.
Sure. This is an interesting illustration. And again, maybe I'm being cynical, but you know, we've seen bills pass through the Congress pretty swiftly when they talk about protecting children or child pornography and things like this. And here, national security is another one where, you know, show me a legislator who's not going to think twice about voting against something that's ostensibly about national security.
Right. So a couple of questions as we wrap up the show here. I'm wondering if any of you are going to go out to your local paint store and coat your offices with anti-Wi-Fi paint.
I think I'm going to get aluminum foil first and try that on my windows and maybe an aluminum foil cap as well.
Yes, yes, yes. Well with your anti-Wi-Fi paint.
I think they sell those at EFF, so you can grab one by making a donation.
You know, you get that Wi-Fi. Here's the problem: if you get that anti-Wi-Fi paint and you use it in your office, now your cell phone isn't going to work because it blocks the same signals.
Oh, that's not good. Unless you get the Wi-Fi cell phone, the thing that you can now do, I guess you can make phone calls, you know, because AT&T is now not being so crazy about using the, at least in the iPhone network, the Skype and other providers' Wi-Fi phones. So I don't know.
Yes, and it looks like from the article we linked to here that that's actually not a bug, but a feature as far as movie theaters are concerned, because they've been looking to find a legal way to keep cell phones quiet during movies. So they want to block.
Is there a way they can set something that will turn off the light on the cell phone?
Yeah, that would be great.
Texting is the other thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's certainly not really a legal story, but I thought it was interesting from a law standpoint, since just about every law firm I've ever worked at in the era of Wi-Fi was very hesitant to have any kind of Wi-Fi for security reasons. So, you know, and they can put on their tinfoil hat and paint the walls and maybe all will be okay.
But I see a political cartoon in there somewhere.
Yes. And hopefully it will come in pretty colors. Hey, Colette, did you look at this story on the Ninth Circuit decision that came out on quote-unquote disloyal computing being deemed not illegal?
I didn't. I'm sorry. Okay. I don't know.
We've talked about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act before,
particularly in
the context of the Lori Drew case, where it was used to prosecute her. And this is another CFAA case. And it actually, it looks like, has set up a circuit split so that the issue might make its way to the United States Supreme Court. The Seventh Circuit, I guess, decided one way that if an employee was using the network to obtain information that they weren't authorized to get, competitive information, et cetera, that actually revoked their permission to use their employer network and thus revoked their authorized access under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and they could be prosecuted under that act. And now the Ninth Circuit has come out and said that workers authorized to access company computers do not lose or exceed that access if their intent was to acquire data to open a competing business, which does seem like, you know, that would not be an authorized intent, but they still can't be prosecuted under this act. So just an interesting new development, one to watch. See if maybe the Supremes get interested in that.
Now, that would be interesting to see something from the Supreme Court on the scope. Because of what we've talked about with the Lori Drew situation and the whole, you know, terms of use and people just not really knowing what's in them. I saw an article, maybe I'll send you the link. It's been a few days, actually. Someone's clipped it, literally cut it out of a newspaper and mailed it to me. It was so lovely. I opened my mail. I'm like, oh, this is so antiquated. But it was an article that said, you know, you commit three felonies a day. And it was a short sort of opinion piece. And I'm sure it's in the New York Times. And it was basically that, one of the felonies you might commit, it has to do with this whole issue of, you know, violating a terms of use and then exceeding your authority on a computer system and then being in violation of the CFAA. So I thought it was funny. It's an interesting thing. And so, I mean, I think it's an important issue. We'll see what happens.
Matt, you sent us another U.S. Supreme Court related link related to the Tenenbaum case, not the merits of it, but the coverage of it. You want to expand on that and tell people what happened there? Kind of just a little procedural item.
Sure. Basically, what happened there is that you all may recall a number of years ago, the New York Times had taken the articles of freelancers and allowed those freelancers to, or not allowed, but allowed those articles to be put into an electronic database. The freelancers complained about that, and they said that, you know, they couldn't do that. The New York Times couldn't do that. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court. It ended up in the Ticini case, where the court said, in this electronic. You can take freelancers' articles without their express permission or a license and repurpose it in an electronic database, which was later sort of revisited in another case as a side note, the Greenberg and Faulkner cases against National Geographic in the Second Circuit and in the 11th Circuit. But to return to this this particular issue involving the New York Times freelancers, the Supreme Court said, okay, well, you know, you can't do this, so we're sending this back to the district court. District court said, okay, well, I'm encouraging the New York Times to enter into a settlement agreement with the class of freelancers. This was a class action to enter into a settlement agreement with the class. The plaintiff class action lawyer apparently did enter into a proposed settlement agreement, and several of the freelancers said, well, wait a second, you can't enter into a settlement agreement with all of us or on behalf of all of us because we didn't register our works with the U.S. Copyright Office. So even though we have a copyright, because copyright comes into effect without registration, the unregistered works – you can't go to court if you haven't registered your works. So how can there be a class action that benefits unregistered works? So that's essentially what the question is that went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The district court in New York, I think it was the Southern District of New York, said I do have the jurisdiction to allow for there to be a settlement on behalf of a class, even those members of the class whose works were not registered. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals said, no, you don't have that jurisdiction. And so that's sort of the question that is that was argued before the Supreme Court. And I think the question about jurisdiction extends beyond class actions to even individual plaintiff lawsuits, because when you look at things like open source software, how many open source software developers that make improvements actually register those improvements with the Copyright Office? And if they don't register those improvements with the Copyright Office, then who has the standing to bring a lawsuit, for example, under the GPL, General Public License, versions 2 or 3, to bring a lawsuit in the open source software world? So it's kind of an interesting issue, I think, that extends beyond class action lawsuits and procedurally.
Yes, and I'm sorry about the awkward introduction to having you talk about that. I was actually thinking about another Supreme Court action, which was to decline to review Joel Tenenbaum's appeal about streaming video of his court proceedings over the internet. And I got a little confused about where our stories came from. But yes, that one is a very interesting one about the scope of registration and what it's going to get or not get you as far as the court's ability to grant relief. So thanks for bringing that to our attention. We are getting to the end of our allotted time for the show, and I'm sad because we had a few more things to talk about, but maybe we can get to them on next week's edition of TWiL. Before we go, though, I did want to give Matt the chance to talk about the IP Institute that you have coming up in Dana Point. You want to briefly plug that as we sign off here?
Sure. Thank you so much for giving me that opportunity. The intellectual property section of the State Bar of California has an annual Intellectual Property Institute. We've got the 34th annual IP Institute coming up November 12th through the 14th. Very interesting this year. It's being led by Jimmy Nguyen, who is the incoming chair of the executive committee for the IP section. We instituted awards this year called the Vanguard Awards for leaders in intellectual property. I don't have the list in front of me, but one of the award recipients under the category of jurists, there's only one category, one recipient for jurist, and that is Judge Matz, who decided the VO case the UMG VO case. So it'll be interesting to see what he has to say. We've got Mark Lemley as a recipient of the awards, Greg Gechner, and I forgot who the other person was. I'm sorry.
James Shaywald.
Thank you. Thank you. And so we're also going to be tweeting from the IP Institute this year. We've got a fashion show in conjunction with the awards ceremony, and we figured let's see how social networking works. Maybe we could have a little commentary of tweets with during the fashion show and the award portion. So if you want to find us, we're at IP Section on Twitter, and you can look for the hashtag of 34IPI before, during, and after the Institute. And thanks for
allowing me to give that a plug. So you're not imposing a ban on live tweeting that event?
No. As a matter of fact, and thank you. That's very funny. No, we're encouraging it. We want to see how that works out.
Yeah, I definitely want to see lots of twit pics of the IP law-related fashion show, because that's got to be pretty humorous. I, in fact, could partake in that fashion show right now. I don't know if folks can see, but I've got my Creative Commons shirt on. I am not for commercial use and for attribution today on my shirt. So hopefully we'll see more more kind of interesting IP-related fashion, and I would be very interested to attend and see how we can have Mark Lemley and Greg Gechner? Gechner? Is that how you say his name?
Yeah, I think it's Gechner. Gechner. And he's from the MPAA.
Right. On the same podium at the same time receiving a Vanguard Award. That will be interesting.
Yep. Should be pretty interesting. I've been on panels with I think I was on one panel with Greg, and even though the MPA member companies were suing the company that I was general counsel of, we got along quite well. It's, you know, we're all adults, and we take positions on behalf of our clients that we believe in and advocate zealously. And so, but that should be kind of fun to see Mark and Greg both receiving the awards, and of course it's also interesting to have Judge Matz there.
Yes, very much. All right. Well, thank you for letting us know about that. NetDoc66 in the chat room wants to know if his Wi-Fi or her Wi-Fi carpet will have a Twitter account. But in the meantime, Colette Vogel has a Twitter account at Vogel Law. Go follow her there. Gordon Firemark has three Twitter accounts. You want to plug them all, Gordon?
Well, no, two of them are sort of adjunct. I had started one and some people followed, and then when I changed over to a different format and structure, some of them didn't follow, so I've just kept it going. My primary Twitter account is gfiremark, at gfiremark, and I do have one for the podcast, which is Ent Law Update.
Wonderful. So folks, go out and follow our panelists. Matt Nico is Matt_Nico. I am at D Howell, and we are thrilled that you've joined us for This Week in Law. We will see you next week. Same place, same bat channel. Thanks a lot. See you then.